All by themselves, statistics can be deadly and dry and boring as all get out, and they never tell the whole story. Nonetheless, statistics can be revealing, eye-opening, sometimes even staggering. In the past 2 weeks, three different sets of numbers have stopped me dead in my tracks. Just 3 minutes from these doors and this room where we sit lies an apartment complex that now goes by the title of Parkside Commons. The complex has 14 buildings, almost 400 apartments, 800 residents, including almost 300 children. The people who live there are largely single parents. Over half of them are Hispanic. And over 60% of the residents report having absolutely no income whatsoever. They simply live from day to day without any change and without any hope. They clearly live at the far end and opposite end of the same street from where the luxury apartments complex sits right next door to us, to a very different world at that end of the street. The second set of statistics had to do with the rate of poverty in the city of Syracuse as a whole. Using the federal thresholds that define poverty as an annual income of $11,000 maximum for a single person and $19,000 for a family of three, nearly 40% of all Syracuse city residents live below the poverty line, twice as much, over twice as much as the national average. When we begin to look at particular groups of city residents, the numbers are even worse. More than half of all Asians, including a large portion of our refugees, dwell in poverty. Almost half of all Latinos live in poverty. 45% of all African Americans fall below the poverty line. But the largest single subgroup living in poverty in Syracuse are children and teenagers, with fully 55% of them living, if you can call it that, below the poverty line. Just so you can compare them, that's almost 50,000 residents in the city of Syracuse out of a population of 144,000, including 18,000 children and youth, in a city school district that gathers together some 19,000 children, 84% of whom qualify for free and reduced lunches. The final statistic that grabbed my attention in the past couple of weeks came from Deb Virgo, who is now leading our Friday community food pantry and who reports that half of the persons we serve each week, each month, come from outside our assigned area and neighborhood, including some persons from Parkside Commons who make their way here down the mile in order to find food for the week ahead. This puts a definite strain on our pantry budget, which is why your monthly donations are so valuable. And it forces us to ask an important question: do we turn people away because they live on the wrong street, or do we find a way to serve them and feed them no matter what? The Outreach Committee is working on that very question as we speak. So what are we to make of this avalanche of numbers? At the very least, it tells me that hunger and poverty and their offshoots of crime, violence, drugs, disaffection, fear, resignation blanket large portions of this community. And somebody has got to do something about it. The question is, who? Whose problem is it? Whose worry is it? Whose responsibility is it? For those of us who are people of faith who believe in God and believe that God has placed us here on earth with a moral conscience to care about the world around us, this question about what to do about poverty and hunger is not just an ethical question or a political question. It is preeminently a theological question. To those who argue that this is simply a matter of economics, how much can we afford as a church, as a county, as a state, as a nation? We say no. It's not about this economic theory or that economic theory. It's about the economics of God. Just ask Jeremiah. Just ask the rich man in Jesus' parable. To those who argue that this question is merely a political or philosophical one, we say no. It's not about Republican politics or Democrat politics, and it's not about individual responsibility versus social responsibility. It's about God's politics and our responsibility to God, our ability to respond to what we know about God. Just ask Jeremiah. Just ask the rich man in Jesus' story. According to Jesus, our caring for our neighbors, whoever they may be, wherever they may come from, is not ever a matter of good deeds alone. It's about the fate of our own souls, to put it pure and simple. Do you think I'm exaggerating? Go ask Jeremiah. Go ask the tormented rich man, whose moral and spiritual blindness or indifference has consequences far beyond this life for Lazarus and for himself. If Lazarus were alive today, surely he would be one of the 44 to 50 million persons in this nation, or according to a recent study, the 75 to 80 to 84 million, half of all the working age adults who could not afford to see a doctor or fill a prescription or pay their medical bills last year, and whose potential health coverage is now being held hostage like a bargaining chip in a high-end stakes game of poker or chicken. If Lazarus were alive today, surely he would be among the 30 to 35 million Americans whose food stamp lifeline is now at risk, with 72% of those persons coming from working families with children. But if I read my Bible accurately, Lazarus and all of the Lazaruses are not the problem. I am the problem. It's my soul that's at risk when I stop seeing and caring. The rich man's problem and my problem or sin isn't that I have money in my wallet or money in the bank. The sin comes in isolating myself from other human beings, from persons in need, thinking that somebody else should do something. Doesn't automatically mean that I have to empty my checkbook every time I pass by Lazarus. But when I stop noticing, when I stop caring, when I stop agonizing, that's when my soul starts shriveling up and dying. Friday morning, I was downstairs visiting with members of our Friday community and food pantry. There was a woman there, call her Lazarus, someone I had helped a couple of weeks ago along with her daughter, call her Lazarus Jr. When she spotted me, she jumped up, greeted me warmly, thanked me all over again for what I had done for her using funds this church puts available for me into what's called the pastor's discretionary fund. Then, without pausing, she pointed to another woman. Call her Lazarus II. Grabbed her by the hand, pulled her up out of her seat, pushed her in front of me, saying, "You'll help her too, right?" Instantly, I was on the defensive. Worse than that, I was annoyed, peeved, irritated. I like being in control. I felt used. Was that all I was some kind of walking ATM? I quickly calculated that if I helped Lazarus number two, the word would get out and then there'd be no stopping. An endless number of Lazaruses stretching out the door, down the street, around the corner, all of them with their hands out, asking for money, expecting help. I felt trapped, overwhelmed, powerless. All because Lazarus number one wanted her friend to experience the same kindness and help that she had earlier. Inwardly, I squirmed and fidgeted while doing my best to tap dance around the request. Eventually, I came to realize that managing the emergency funds that I am in charge of is important. But so too is managing the well-being of my soul and the souls of those around me. And the day that I too quickly and easily dismiss any cry for help is the day I'm one step closer to landing in the fires or icy coldness of hell. So, who is the Lazarus in your life? The person who sits just outside your door or your heart, day after day, month after month, year after year, so long that they've become like wallpaper to you, invisible, hardly noticed anymore. Who is the Lazarus for you whose needs and demands, even if they are silent, are a thorn in your side and a pain in your behind? And what if that's not all they are? What if they are also angels from God? Holy irritants. Meant to remind you and me of what it means to be human. Meant also to bring us close to the love of God in this world and in the world to come. Lazarus. Lazarus. Help me to pay attention. For your sake. And for mine. Amen.